Certainly good to see everyone this morning. Last second Sunday, talked about how that so often as preachers we probably don't always consider, or at least correctly consider, and preach the things that need to be preached. And I mentioned some of the doctrinal things that perhaps have been left out over time. Then I went third Sunday to Taylor's Crossroads and preached the same sermon. After everything was over, I'm gathering up my projector and things, and I notice Greg Moore and Lee and Ben McManus all huddled up talking. They're not that far from me, and I can hear they're discussing my sermon. I'm like, uh-oh, I done messed up. Said something they didn't like. But they were discussing some of the things I'd said and kind of comparing notes and realizing that a lot of those things, in fact, Greg said to me later, when it comes to the located preacher, as we often call it, said the best he could remember, he had never heard a sermon in his life on that. He looked at me and said, I know it's wrong, but I don't know why. He said, I've never heard anything about it. Now, I don't know how long he's been in the church, but he goes way back to the Godby Road days in Atlanta. That's kind of sad. And all the meetings he's been to, and here, in this county and everywhere else, he said that the best he can remember, he's never heard anything about it. And I wonder how many others could say the same thing. Well, I know it's supposed to be wrong, but why? And if we're like that, then how are we different than folks we so often criticize in the denominational world? We criticize them for doing things that aren't scriptural. And I bet many of them would say, well, I know it's supposed to be right, but I don't know why. Things they do, things they believe, things they teach and accept. Yet they can't point out the scriptures why they do it. And yet so often we condemn practices, and if we can't point to the scripture and say, well, here's why we do what we do, and here's why we don't do these things, are we therefore any different? So I want us to look this morning at what's often called the minister. I want us to take a scriptural look at what we're going to call the one-man preacher system, the located preacher system, whatever you want to call it. It is the predominant method in most every church you will see. There's a man or a woman these days, and we're not even going there. That's a whole different topic. Where one man is generally given the job, and it is a job, a paid job in most cases, to do all the preaching. And let's see what the scriptures have to say about this. We really do need to understand this. Let's first get a foundation, and this could be a foundation for any of the topics that I mentioned, or really for most things we talk about. And one of my favorite passages in the scriptures. For my thoughts are not your thoughts, neither are your ways my ways, saith the Lord. For as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts. We need to really stop and think. We cannot sit down and figure things out independent of the Bible. That's what the world tries to do. And always has. Just because something seems to make sense to us doesn't make it right. Look at world affairs. Things where God's left out of it. Is this world in good shape? Or is this world pretty much in a mess? Governments rise and they fall. Everything the government puts its hands to seems to eventually go the wrong way. I'm not a big fan of entrusting government with anything more than we have to. In our country, they bankrupted Social Security. Education's not what it needs to be. So many things that the government has its hand in, and it has nothing to do with any political party. Just government in general doesn't seem to turn out well in many cases. It says, I forget which founding father said, kind of a necessary evil. There is a way which seemeth right unto a man, but the end thereof are the ways of death. If we can't prove it in the scriptures, we need to leave it alone. And what we do in our personal life, to some degree, is up to us. Obviously we've got to be moral, we've got to follow the Bible, but everything's not laid out for us exactly how we do things in our personal life. The church, however, is a different story. We are told what to do. Now, human nature. And here's where we get into trouble. We follow human nature. We kind of do things that seem right to us. And we then kind of make the Bible fit what we think should be. That's how you get all these different beliefs and practices. People have, over time, come up with ideas that they thought were good, and they'll excuse them as being more modern, more efficient. They have their different reasons, but then they'll tend to make the Bible fit that, or they'll just dismiss the Bible in that area and say it doesn't apply anymore, it's out of date, or it was wrong, or this or that. They have all kind of ways of excusing changes. Now, we're going to read 20 verses here, but you can't teach this subject correctly, I don't think, without going through this passage. The parallels are just overwhelming. It came to pass when Samuel was old that he made his sons judges over Israel. Now the name of the firstborn was Joel, and the name of the second, Abiah. They were judges in Beersheba. And his sons walked not in his ways, but turned aside after lucre, money, and took bribes and perverted judgment. Not a good situation, but that's politics. Then all the elders of Israel gathered themselves together and came to Samuel unto Ramah and said unto him, Behold, thou art old, and thy sons walk not in thy ways. Now make us a king to judge us like all the nations. And notice some things said here in this verse. First of all, didn't say, well, you've made your son judges, that ain't working out. They're corrupt, they're not following in your steps. Can you find some other capable, honest men to fill this position? They didn't say that, did they? They weren't interested in having judges doing things the way God wanted to do it. What did they say? Now make us a king to judge us like all the nations. Was what's commonly today called peer pressure. You look around and was a kid at school, sees other kids wearing this kind of shoe or this kind of jeans, or they're talking about this show they watch on TV or whatever it is. Well, then, you know, this kid's got to be just like all the rest. And as adults, are we much different? We see people wearing certain style of clothes. I mean, just the whole idea of things coming in and out of style. We just have to kind of move with the masses. And, you know, and look like everybody else and drive the same cars and do this and that just like everybody else. And that's exactly what was going on here. They look around. All these other nations have kings. And we're kind of odd here. We don't have a king. We're different. We want to be just like everybody else. But the thing displeased Samuel when they said, Give us a king to judge us. And Samuel prayed unto the Lord. And the Lord said unto Samuel, Hearken unto the voice of the people and all that they say unto thee. For they have not rejected thee, but they have rejected me, that I should not reign over them. Samuel, it's nothing against you. Your sons aren't doing the job they should, but they're rejecting the system that I put in place, the way that I chose to govern them. They're rejecting me, Samuel, not you. According to all the works which they have done since the day that I brought them up out of Egypt, even unto this day, wherewith they have forsaken me and served other gods, so do they also unto thee. Now therefore hearken unto their voice, howbeit yet protest solemnly unto them, and show them the manner of the king that shall reign over them. God said, they want a king? Fine. Give it to them. But tell them what it's going to cost them. And Samuel told all the words of the Lord unto the people that asked of him a king. And he said, This will be the manner of the king that shall reign over you. He will take your sons and appoint them for himself, for his chariots, and to be his horsemen. And some shall run before his chariots. And he will appoint him captains over thousands, and captains over fifties. And will set them to ear his ground, and to reap his harvest, and to make his instruments of war, and instruments of his chariots. And he will take your daughters to be confectionaries, and to be cooks, and to be bakers. And he will take your fields, and your vineyards, and your oliveyards, even the best of them, and give them to his servants. And he will take the tenth of your seed and of your vineyards and give to his officers and to his servants. And he will take your men servants and your maid servants and your goodliest young men and your asses and put them to his work. And he will take the tenth of your sheep and you shall be his servants. And you shall cry out in that day because of your king, which ye shall have chosen you. And the Lord will not hear you in that day. Nevertheless, the people refused to obey the voice of Samuel, and they said, Nay, But we will have a king over us. The Lord said, what? We don't care. We will have... Notice that. It didn't say we want. We will have a king over us. We don't care what the Lord says. We have rejected him. Now, they didn't say it in those words, but that's what the meaning was. We will have us a king. Period. That we also may be like all the nations, and that our king may judge us and go out before us and fight our battles. Now, why does this have application to what I'm talking about? You know, 100 years ago, Churches of Christ didn't have ministers, preachers of one congregation. But then they began to look around. Catholics had priests, Episcopalians, Baptists, Methodists, all these other groups. They had their preachers or priests or whatever you want to call them. And we were different. Didn't like being different. And so things began to change. I'm going to take those last two verses there. Nevertheless, the people refused to obey the voice of Samuel, and they said, nay, we will have a king over us, that we also may be like all the nations, and that our king may judge us and go out before us and fight our battles. And I'm going to modernize it a little bit. What have those said who have changed things and decided to have a preacher over them? Nevertheless, the people refused to obey the voice of... When the last passage we're going to look at is going to hit this straight on. Jesus. And they said, nay, but we will have a preacher over us, that we also may be like all the churches. We don't want to be different. And that our preacher may, what's he supposed to do? Teach us. That's why he went to college. He learned all about the Bible and he can come teach us. That way, we don't have to study for ourselves, do we? And go out before us and visit the sick and teach the lost. That way, we don't have to do it. Right? That's what a lot of it's about. Put money in the collection, pay the preacher, the sick are getting visited. Those who, you know, quit coming, they get visited and talked to. Those who need converting, we'll sick the preacher on them. Preacher will study for us and teach us. It's all getting done, right? We're just paying to have it done instead of doing it ourselves. God is the king. That part we need not forget. God makes the rules. Israel rejected God as their king. We want a man who we can look at and look up to be our king. Not a God in heaven that we can't see, that we don't really trust, don't have faith in. God's intent for the government of Israel, how he wanted them to be governed. Each city was independent. There was no central government in Israel. Now, that makes sense, and we're going to step back and think about it in a little bit. That really made sense. The elders of each city were the leaders. There was leadership there, it just was not centralized as a whole nation. God guided things. He controlled things. And when there was a need, he sent prophets, judges. If the people needed to be delivered from an enemy, and they only needed that because they had strayed away from God, he had allowed them to be afflicted by the Philistines or somebody else, then they would repent. He'd send somebody to deliver them. Now, other than the prophets, whom God spoke to and instructed directly, no individuals ever had authority. Individuals were never given authority. God's intent for the governance of the church. Each congregation is independent with no central authority or government. Same principle. God does it right the first time. He doesn't have to invent a new way to govern things. The elders of each congregation should provide their leadership. God still provides a guidance and leadership through the Scriptures. He doesn't send prophets. He already sent the prophet, Jesus. We listen to Him and His disciples. All of us, men and women, are instructed directly from the Scriptures. So God is now basically talking directly to all of us through the Scriptures. We don't need a prophet to be talked to by God, then tell us He's already done that. We have everything we need. Again, other than the apostles, again, who were directly instructed by Jesus, no individuals ever had authority in the church. You cannot open the Scriptures and show where any individual, other than the apostles, had true authority in the church. Now, why does God choose this way? We know men are corruptible. Men stray, do things we should not. I'm not just saying men, men and women. That's being human. If you give a man authority, there's a good chance he may abuse that authority. And if that man decides to do things that aren't right, and he's got authority, he can lead others to do those things that aren't right also. That's the danger. But if that man is part of a group, the elders of the city, the elders of the congregation, it's a lot harder for that one man who's got these bad ideas to ever do anything about it. That's the wisdom in God's plan. Now, if that individual does manage to corrupt his group, you get a church that goes corrupt, or a city back in Israel went corrupt, there's no real connection, leadership-wise, to other churches or other cities that would spread that corruption. So any corruption that would happen would be slow. That's God's wisdom. Whereas when you started to centralize things, when the papacy began to form, look how far Catholicism is from the Bible. As soon as you had a small group of individuals, or really one individual in charge, they were gone, out in left field and then some. Because there was no checks and balances anymore. You know, in this congregation, if one person comes up with some strange ideas and wants to bring in all these new doctrines, it'd be very hard to do. Because there's a lot of people they would have to convince, and that's not easy. What generally happens in our kind of congregation, if something like that does get started, the church usually ends up splitting. It's not like the whole group just kind of moves en masse to start following some false doctrine. No individual should ever have a unique position within the church. It's not found in the Bible. There were elders, plural, there were deacons that were seen in the church, but there was no position that was unique and one individual held it in a church. It didn't happen. That's modern. All right, the one-man system. What do we call him? Different denominations have different titles. Now, elders have a title spelled out in the Scriptures. Actually, they have several. In about four different places, the word elder is used. Once pastor, once overseer, once presbyter, where Presbyterians get their name, and once the title bishop is used. All of these refer to what we normally call elder. Now, if I had to say that the Scriptures tend to use one of these words as a title, it's bishop. Why don't we use that one? I think because it's been so used and abused by some denominations that we tend to stray away from that. None of these are necessarily any better than the other. We stick with elder. Elders have qualifications spelled out in the Scriptures in two places by Paul. Deacons have a title, given in 1 Timothy 3. Deacons have qualifications, also given by Paul once in this case, in 1 Timothy 3. So, elders and deacons, they have titles, they have qualifications, spelled out in the Scriptures. What's the preacher's title? Where do we find that in the Scriptures? What we call this person who is hired to do most or all of the preaching in a congregation? Could it be preacher? That word's certainly in the Bible. Minister, reverend, father, bishop, pastor. All of these are used in some form or another by many denominations. Can any of these scripturally be applied in the way they're actually used by so many people today? Let's examine them, each in turn. All right, what is a preacher? Someone who preaches, right? You know the word preacher only occurs 4 times in the New Testament? That kind of surprised me. I figured it'd be all over the place, but it's not. 3 times is from one Greek word, which means a herald. Someone who speaks the divine truth, the gospel. The other time, it's a version of the same word, a herald, a public crier. Nothing here that mentions anything about a position. It just means somebody who's proclaiming the gospel. That's all it means. Anybody who gets up and teaches the gospel is a preacher, plain and simple. So that one really doesn't work for a position within the church. But minister, this is what so many, including the liberal churches of Christ, will often use to refer to this person they have hired into this job. They call him their minister. Minister is used in the New Testament as both a noun and a verb, talking about someone acting as a minister, and also to minister to someone, to help someone. 3 Greek words are used and translated as minister in the noun form, a total of 15 times. One of these is to row. It's only used once. An under oarsman, a subordinate, an assistant, minister, officer, servant. Did you notice that word servant? It shows up a lot. This is someone, you know, this is certainly not what we see in churches today. It's definitely not talking about that. One word here is used twice. A public servant, a functionary in the temple or gospel, a worshiper of God. Notice the word servant again. Again, this still doesn't refer to what we see today. And then the one that occurs most of the time, diakonos, which is related to the word deacon, to run errands, an attendant, a waiter, Christian teacher, and pastor. So it's technically a deacon. Deacon, minister, servant. All of those come back to the word servant. A minister is nothing more than someone who serves. That's what the word minister means, to serve, to help. So in none of these do we really get the idea of a position. Any servant of God is a minister. Plain and simple. There's no position by that name in the Scriptures. Who does the Bible refer to as being a minister or ministering? The first Greek word we looked at, Paul, is the one who's referred to in that sense. The second word, which was used twice, Jesus is actually referred to by that term, and so is Paul. And then the third one, carnal rulers are spoken of using this term. They're servants to God, in the sense that they make laws and rules, as Alex mentioned in his prayer. And you know, we hope they make good ones. Jesus is referred to twice by this term. Paul 3 times. Tychicus twice. Epaphras once. Timothy twice. Now, if we examine these men, you're never going to find in these passages or anywhere else where they were serving as the minister, the preacher in a church. And you know, and I would, if time allowed, look at all these passages. They really should be looked at, but time doesn't permit. Time to not go too long today as it is. All right, the verb form. Again, you can see the relation to the word deacon there. An attendant, to wait upon, menially, as a host, friend, Christian deacon, again, serve, servant. That's all this word means. All right, what about reverend? This is the one here that really bothers me. This word occurs once in the Bible. If I'm introduced to somebody, and I will not use the word reverend. I don't care who I insult, I will not do it. Because that word is used one time in the Bible, and it refers to God. He sent redemption unto his people. He hath commanded his covenant forever. Holy and reverend is his name. And it's not even using it here as a title. Reverend, to revere, have reverence for, great respect for. Now, the only time the word's used in the Bible, it's used and applied toward God. No man should be on such a high pedestal, other than Jesus, that we revere them so much that we would make up a title such as this to give to them. No man deserves that. Only God should be revered in that sense. So that one's definitely out. About Father. And call no man your father upon the earth, for one is your Father, which is heaven. That's all we need to say about that one. God said, don't do it. Some denominations do it, you know. What else can you say? Bishop, for this cause left I thee in Crete, he says to Titus, that thou shouldest set in order the things that are wanting, and ordain elders in every city as I had appointed thee. If any be blameless, the husband of one wife, having faithful children, not accused of right or unruly. For a bishop must be, using the word bishop and elder interchangeably here, the same thing. So we're back to elder. So bishop is not an appropriate title for someone preaching in a church or having higher authority over several churches. It's not scriptural. Pastor, commonly used by many denominations. It's from the Greek word poimen, means a shepherd. That's all it means. Now, it occurs 18 times, this Greek word, in the New Testament. Only three of these are after the establishment of the church. So only three could possibly be used in that context. So look at them. Two of these refer to Jesus. He wasn't even alive when the church was established. So we know, and for other reasons also, that he obviously wasn't holding some office like this in a church. The other is this one. And he gave some apostles and some prophets and some evangelists and some pastors and teachers. Now, we know what apostles are. We know what prophets are. Evangelists, I think we know. We're going to talk about that in a minute. We know what teachers are. What's a pastor? It's a shepherd. It's an elder. All of those are interchangeable. Pastor, elder, presbyter, overseer, shepherd. They all mean the same thing. And certainly that's the only occurrence of the word pastor. Only time that it's ever translated that in the New Testament. And that's certainly not some new position. It's never referenced anywhere else. What are the preacher's qualifications? Now, think about it. We know of two, and I'll call them positions, offices, whatever word you want to use in the church. Twice Paul gave qualifications for elders, once for deacons. If there is another office or position in the church, where are the qualifications for it? They should be there. They're not. Each of the other two, very clear qualifications. Yet the preacher, who in so many cases wields the majority of the authority in churches, has no qualifications. That doesn't make sense. Some denominations have deacons and one elder. They'll often refer to as the pastor. I've heard some call it, you know, talk about their board of deacons, which really wield a good bit of authority, but when we look at deacons in the Bible, they have no authority really. They're meant to labor more in a physical sense. When the seven were appointed, Stephen being one of them, Philip another, they were to serve widows. Now, certainly they should be spiritual, but that wasn't their primary area of labor. Now, notice these passages and the fact there's always a plurality of elders. And when they had ordained them elders in every church, and it pleased the apostles and elders with the whole church, and from Miletus he sent to Ephesus and called the elders of the church, this cause left I thee in Crete that thou shouldest set in order the things that are wanting, and ordain elders in every city, as I had appointed thee. Is any sick among you? Let him call for the elders of the church. Now again, many denominations get around, they're not being anything about a preacher. It's really their pastor. They're using the idea of the elder and the qualifications for it. But we always see a plurality. Again, we get back to the point, just like in old Israel, no individual ever had a unique position other than those directly instructed by God, the prophets. Same is true in the church. No individual should ever have a singular position and authority. Always multiple elders. Wait a minute, I forgot something, didn't I? We could have a senior pastor, assistant pastor, youth pastor. And you know, and I get to listen sometimes to some of the kids at school. They have their minister of music and all these other positions. Like, where did these things come from? They just create position upon position upon position. Again, I can't emphasize that enough. No individual should ever have a singular position that makes them unique and gives them authority in that sense. That's dangerous. That's against God's plan. Liberal churches of Christ, and in this day, many of them don't even try to defend scripturally what they do. It's accepted among their people, and they just go forward with it. Back in the day when churches were splitting over this issue, the way that they defended having a minister is to call him an evangelist. And I'm sure if questioned, some of the older ones in the liberal churches would still use that term. The word evangelist occurs three times in the Bible. Once in a general sense, the passage we just read, made some teachers and pastors and evangelists, that's general, says nothing to help us here. The other two are involving people, Philip and Timothy. So let's look at them very quickly and see what they did. Philip. Then Philip went down to the city of Samaria and preached Christ unto them. And the angel of the Lord spake unto Philip, saying, Arise and go toward the south, unto the way that goeth down from Jerusalem unto Gaza, which is the desert, where he met up with the eunuch. But Philip was found at Azotus, and passing through he preached in all the cities, till he came to Caesarea, where he lived. He went from place to place. All the record we have of him in the Bible, really, other than one other time where he hosted Paul when he was passing through, he's going from here to here to here preaching. He was not in one city as the preacher in a church. That's not found in the Bible. So what we gather from Philip being called an evangelist is that essentially of a traveling teacher going from place to place teaching the gospel. Timothy. Him would Paul have to go forth with him. Traveling with Paul. So he sent into Macedonia two of them that ministered unto him, Timotheus, or Timothy. So now he's sending Timothy somewhere. For this cause have I sent unto you Timotheus, who's my beloved son. And so he's sending him to Corinth now. For the Son of God, Jesus Christ, who is preached among you, even by me and Silvanus and Timotheus. So we see that when he was with Paul, he was preaching. He sent him to Philippi. But I trust in the Lord Jesus to send Timotheus shortly unto you, to Thessalonica, and sent Timotheus, our brother and minister of God. Now, he traveled all over the place with Paul, and Paul, I think he was Paul's most trusted assistant, if you will. And Paul constantly would send him here and here and here, wherever Paul couldn't go. Particularly after Paul was under arrest in Rome, he could send Timothy these places. Again, we don't get the idea of someone being paid to preach in a congregation. Very different. So they use that word evangelist, you know, and say, he's here in our area evangelizing this area. Now, should evangelists still exist? Absolutely. I know of one in the church today, and he lives right over there, Harry. But we don't pay Harry to evangelize this area. Now, certainly, you know, if he gets an opportunity, he's going to try to convert people anywhere. But to pay someone to preach in a congregation and to work in this area, that's just not seen in the Scriptures. All right, Paul was asked to spend a little while at Ephesus, and we know Paul spent about 2.5 years at Ephesus. I besought thee to abide still at Ephesus when I went into Macedonia, that thou mightest teach some, that they charge some that they teach no other doctrine. That doesn't mean he was sent there as a stint to be their preacher. No indication of that in the Scriptures. Notice something else Paul told Timothy. And the things that thou hast heard of me among many witnesses, the same commit thou to faithful men who shall be able to teach others also. Some might say, well, that's just privately. No, I think it's publicly. That should always be the job of any preacher of the gospel, try to get others to do the same thing. The more, the better. So Timothy traveled, preached the gospel just like Philip. No evidence that either one ever had a job at a specific congregation. Now, I didn't tell the people who were about to be mentioned up here that I was going to use them, but I hope they won't mind. Sometimes when you address letters, you know, most of them they're to individuals. But sometimes, this time of the year, Christmas cards are addressed to families. Now, if one was going to Alex's family, it might read to Alex Frederick, no big deal. It might read to Terry Frederick, or Jacob, or Caleb. Any of those could receive something in the mail. Even my kids who can't, you know, aren't big enough to read can get stuff in the mail addressed to them from who knows where. It might say the Frederick family. It might say Alex Frederick and family. You see all these kind of labelings. It might say Alex, Terry, Jacob, and Caleb Frederick. Would any of these raise an eyebrow to anybody? I don't think so. But what if one arrived and it said this? Alex, Terry, and Caleb. And Jacob would say, well, what about me? You wouldn't generally do that, would you? If you're going to try to include different people in the family, you include all of them. Or I've seen before, you might say Alex, Terry, and family, or something like that. But you don't leave people out. Now, why do I bring this up? What does it matter? Notice a letter addressed to the Philippians. Paul and Timotheus, the servants of Jesus Christ, to all the saints in Christ Jesus, which are at Philippi, with the bishops, deacon, and minister. Wait a minute. Does it say that? That is how Paul would have to write it today, isn't it? Now, that's not what the Bible says. But that's, if you were addressing a letter to a church today, you'd have to do it just like that. What does it really say? There's no minister mentioned. Now, this is not Corinth. This is not a church with all kind of problems. This was a church that was mature, very spiritual. He commended them, you know, for sending money to him. They were working. They were doing what they were supposed to. You read that letter, nothing bad to say to them. Encouraging them, thanking them, teaching them. Now, if churches were supposed to have ministers, why doesn't he mention the minister? That should be the first person mentioned, probably. Didn't exist, did it? Or if they didn't have one at the time, no advice about how to conduct a search for a good minister? Or if they had one among their own number, they should give that position to? It didn't exist in the early church. There were only three categories of people. He mentions the saints, that's those not occupying an office. Then he mentions the bishops and the deacons. That's it. Who was doing the teaching? Take heed, therefore, unto yourselves and to all the flock over the which the Holy Ghost has made you overseers. This is to Ephesus. To feed the church of God, which he hath purchased with his own blood. He's talking here to the elders at Ephesus. He said, it's your job to feed the flock. Does that mean they're the only ones who could teach? No. But the teaching was their responsibility. And certainly they would encourage younger men to teach also, but they had the oversight of it. Certainly nothing here about them hiring one person to do it. Now, I said we would pretty much end with a passage by Jesus. Verily, verily, I say unto you, he that entereth not by the door into the sheepfold, but climbeth up some other way, the same is a thief and a robber. But he that entereth in by the door is the shepherd of the sheep. To him the porter openeth, and the sheep heareth his voice, and he calleth his own sheep by name, and leadeth them out. And when he putteth forth his own sheep, he goeth before them. And the sheep follow him, for they know his voice. And a stranger will they not follow, but will flee from him, for they know not the voice of strangers. This parable spake Jesus unto them, but they understood not what things they were which he spake unto them. Then said Jesus unto them again, Verily, verily, I say unto you, I am the door of the sheep. All that ever came before me are thieves and robbers, but the sheep did not hear them. I am the door. By me, if any man enter in, he shall be saved, and shall go in and out, and find pasture. The thief cometh not, but for to steal, and to kill, and to destroy. I am come that they may have life, and that they may have it more abundantly. I am the good shepherd. The good shepherd giveth his life for the sheep. But he that is an hireling, and not the shepherd, whose own the sheep are not, seeth the wolf coming, and leaveth the sheep, and fleeth, and the wolf catcheth them, and scattereth the sheep. The hireling fleeth, because he is an hireling, and careth not for the sheep. What's he teaching us here? When a man owns sheep, if he hires someone to watch those sheep, he's putting them at jeopardy, because that person he's hired is not going to risk what the shepherd himself would risk. You know, if you have a wild animal trying to attack the sheep, that person who's hired, he's not going to stick his neck out, risk injury or death, trying to save sheep that don't even belong to him. How does that apply to what we're talking about? Hire in a man from who knows where, comes into a congregation, and he's paid to do a job. Problems arise. You know, major problems. Is he going to get right in the middle of that and get involved in who knows what? When in so many cases, he can go, you know, the next county, the next state somewhere, get another job. If he doesn't have vested interest in that community and in those people, why stay? That happens a lot. Some denominations, the preachers are placed by, you know, some authority somewhere in a congregation for a period of time and then moved, and they move them around every so often. It's a career. That in and of itself is a major problem. When you preach for pay, it's a conflict of interest. One of the biggest ones you can have. Remember what Paul told Timothy? For the time will come when they will not endure sound doctrine, but after their own lusts shall they heap to themselves teachers, having itching ears. What's the surest way to get a preacher to preach what you want? Have his paycheck in your hand. That way, when you go to talk to him and say, we, you know, really aren't sure about what you've been saying, you've got his attention. That's his career. Probably providing a house, maybe a car, certainly a paycheck. He's not free to teach the truth. He's got to teach what they want taught. Preachers can be paid. That's not an issue. And again, we could talk about that for several minutes, but we won't. The preacher, however, must be doing scriptural work. Now, in so many cases, when you go into congregations that have ministers, preachers, in that sense, they're the leader of the congregation. They get more respect and have more authority than elders in churches who have them. It's the elder's job to feed the flock, not to hire it to be done. People tend to want a minister to do things for them. Visit the sick. Visit those who aren't coming like they should. Converting the lost. And that's what they feel they're paying him for. I don't see where the scriptures ever give us the option of paying people to do what we're supposed to be doing. It doesn't work that way. And if we're doing that, why can't we just pay him a little more and just we can stay home and he can just take the communion for all of us and just do everything for all of us? It doesn't work that way. We have responsibilities. For there are many unruly and vain talkers and deceivers, especially they of the circumcision, whose mouths must be stopped, who subvert whole houses, teaching things which they ought not, for filthy lucre's sake. How many people are in the world today, men and women, who are teaching things in churches simply because they're paid to do it? Not because it's the truth, not because they really want to necessarily, but it's their job. Feed the flock of God which is among you, taking the oversight thereof, not by constraint, but willingly, not for filthy lucre, but of a ready mind, speaking here to elders. It's elders' job to teach. And what's sad is so many of these big congregations have elders, and they hire them a preacher. Not for filthy lucre, but of a ready mind. We simply cannot find in the Scriptures authority, example, inference, anything that allows us for a moment to believe that it's okay, that God approves of us hiring someone in a position as the preacher in a church. Now again, we could talk for a while about why that shouldn't be the case. Now, no matter how good a preacher is, I mean, there's been times when I've given a lesson, I was thinking, oh, I was on today. Had all these good points. And then somebody, you know, come up and say, you know, I really enjoyed it. And you maybe think about this, and they start mentioning things, and I'm like, why didn't I think of that? You know, I was talking about all this stuff, and here was a better point I didn't even think to make. And that's half the wisdom of the way God's chosen to do it. Nobody is smart enough or good enough that they're going to get it all figured out and know exactly the right things to say. So hearing things from different perspectives, you know, I know this too as a teacher. No matter how good of a teacher you are, you can be teaching your heart out, and you may get 90% of them, they understand it just like this. There's going to be some that they ain't getting it. And another kid or another teacher can say something for about 10 seconds, and the light comes on. People will understand things better from different people. You don't have the problem of one person with authority that they shouldn't have. It's God's wisdom that things be done the way we're doing it. Now, sometimes people will complain that you get people teaching that aren't good and this and that. It shouldn't be about the teacher. It's about the message. And if the person is preaching scriptural things, we're not here to be entertained. We should be thinking about meditating upon what they're teaching and not how they're teaching it. Now, I know some teachers are not as exciting. And our mind tends to wander, but we've got to try to focus. The truth's still there.